Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, revisiting the controversial death of former Arizona Cardinal and U.S. Army Ranger Pat Tillman, and a parent on an upcoming Supreme Court case with major implications for trans kids. But first, it's been about 48 hours since the first votes were cast on Election Day, and it feels like we've been through several political lifetimes since then. And this morning, I wanted to share a few sketches from my reporter's notebook that might help give some additional contour as the storylines that will define our historical memory of this election begin to take hold. I spent election night in Chandler at a restaurant called BKD's Backyard Lounge, speaking to Republican voters. And if you're watching the news or reading the newspaper today and seeing endless headlines about Trump's clear, decisive victory, that is not what the Trump voters that I spoke to that night thought was about to happen.
All you're doing is saving me from a stroke.
Yeah, I know.
So are you feeling a little stressed out?
Anxiety, right? You're kind of hoping it goes your way.
Yeah, you don't know. You're not going to know exactly. But to see those numbers right there, 193, 216, I don't believe that. I really don't.
I don't know. Not confident, but hopeful.
So the reason that I wanted to share that is because the sentiments of these and other voters that I spoke to were pretty much the exact same thing that I remember Joe Biden supporters expressing on election night 4 years ago. A few hours into election night, they felt gripped with this fear that Biden's support was going to evaporate, that Trump had come up with some kind of last-minute strategy to stage a remarkable comeback. That, of course, came to be known as the so-called Red Mirage, but I got the sense that the Trump supporters at BKD on Tuesday night really thought Trump's lead was going to evaporate. And if you're somebody who's looking at the results of this presidential election and wondering if you have anything in common with the other side, well, I think there is a decent chance that you've both experienced the exact same feelings on election night, a sense of utter dread that the reality you thought you were living in is a mirage. Next, I would like to introduce you to Nicholas. Nicholas has a biography that is different from any other Trump supporter I've ever met. He served in the Peace Corps. And if you're hearing that and thinking, I would have assumed that the Peace Corps was all hardcore lefties, Nicholas says, you are correct. He told me he is not strictly a Republican. He voted for Barack Obama in 2008, but he's a Trump supporter now largely because of Trump's stance on immigration. And he told me that his time in the Peace Corps is a big reason for that.
The Peace Corps teaches you, like, you are supposed to capacitate or train or build up the folks that you're working with. So then, therefore, it's sustainable. They have the skills that they need to do better, to manage better. And so it's best when it's done there. But then, you know, I meet a lot of folks now that are just coming up here because the border's open. They just said, well, so it's like my service was wasted.
As I listened to all the conversations the last day or so about the unexpected constituencies that voted for Donald Trump, groups that a lot of people would have assumed would vote for Democrats, I keep thinking back to that conversation with Nicholas. Joining me now in the studio is KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez. Cameron was also out in the field that night. Good morning, Cameron.
Good morning.
So where were you on election night?
I was at the Maricopa County Republican Committee headquarters, also in Chandler, and I gotta tell you, my experience was pretty much the opposite of that. I was at a party where people were super excited the entire night through and very, very confident.
Yes. Well, to start, you have a bunch of amazing stories from that night. I wanted to start by asking you to explain the story behind a text you sent me. That said, quote, there are live snakes here.
Yeah, I don't know why. And I wish I did. But for some reason, there were a few live snakes. I believe they were pythons. There were pets, obviously, of the people. There weren't just rogue snakes at the event. And I got to pet one, and then the owner of that snake was like, do you want to wear the snake? And I was like, okay. So I had it around my neck for a while. But yeah, that was just a fun, fun little detail.
Now, the snakes, it sounds like, were just sort of adornments. Mm-hmm. But there were also some prayers, as I understand it. Tell me about some of the other scenes that really stuck with you.
Right. So at this event, they were watching the results come in on these TV screens set up around the room, and it was all playing this conservative talk show. It's called The Benny Show. And so the guy on that screen who was sort of talking about election night was very, very much a hype man. You know, he was really excited and he was yelling, and he wanted them to call the race before any of the swing states except for North Carolina had been called. He was like, this is over. It's a red wave. And, you know, it looks like it's going to be. But everyone in the room was pretty pretty gung-ho, and I even had someone be like, they should call Pennsylvania now before the votes had come in, and they were saying the media didn't have the guts to do it, basically, and someone turned to me and was like, call Pennsylvania, and I was like, I can't. I can't. It's not my power.
Okay. Well, so that's the story of how KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez was put in a position to ask to call Pennsylvania for President Trump. What would you say, you know, if you compare the experience you had to the one that I had, mm-hmm. It seems like it was a pretty different environment there. It doesn't seem like there was a lot of doubt in the room that things were going to go President Trump's way.
I would say that was the vibe of the room. But when I spoke to people individually, I did ask about election fraud, okay, because it's Maricopa County, Republicans, of course. I was like, where else, you know, is there going to be all the concern about election integrity? And when I was speaking to people one-on-one, they were like, oh, yeah, you know, there isn't any election integrity. One person told me he has exactly zero confidence. That was the quote, zero confidence in our elections, that everything is fraudulent and stolen and rigged against us. And somehow that's reconciled with the confidence and the happiness and the energy of that night. And like you mentioned, there was a prayer. You know, this is more towards the end of the night when it really did seem obvious that Trump was winning and everyone sort of threw their hands up, and this one guy was yelling and saying, thank you, you know, the blood of Jesus, and this is what we wanted. And I've had some avid Trump supporters, not at that event in particular, but at the rallies I've attended and just this whole campaign cycle, telling me that, you know, they believe that Trump actually is the chosen by God.
Well, I have to say that's so interesting, because at BKD's backyard lounge where I was, actually most of the folks in the bar were starting to clear out at 10 o'clock because they had convinced themselves that, just like last time, they were going to wake up in the morning to, if not a Democratic victory, a huge surge of incoming votes for Kamala Harris. And even though at that point, it on all of the news channels, it was becoming very clear that the overwhelming likelihood was a victory for Trump, they just could not believe that that was what was going to happen.
And here we are.
And here we are. All right. Well, that is KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez sharing some notes from her reporter's notebook on election night. Cameron, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
It was something of an odd election night for folks on the Navajo Nation. Despite the printer problems at polling places that forced long lines and a last-minute lawsuit to keep polls open late, there were also some places where the tribal ballot was notably sparse. That's because nearly 200 candidates were disqualified from the ballot as the result of a new campaign finance law they failed to follow. The penalty? Disqualification. Now the question is, what's next? There's been talk of a special election, and some candidates are suing. My co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with Navajo Times reporter Donovan Quintero more about it.
There were nearly 200 tribal candidates who were disqualified. Only one was successful in getting their name back on the ballot?
Yes, that was actually a school board member. The election administration told me that it was a school board member who was reinstated. Also, there was 9 people who actually had their case go through the Navajo Nation Office of Hearings and Appeals. By the sound of it, I'm not privy to this information that takes place at the OHA. Mm-hmm. But that said, the 9 candidates, disqualified candidates, I guess, disagreed with OHA's decision and now have filed with the Navajo Nation Supreme Court. Because of that, any upcoming special election is on hold until those cases are heard and decided on.
Okay, so there is some back and forth going on right now. What did this mean, Donovan, heading into this week's election? Like, were there a lot of positions on the tribal ballot that were just empty, didn't have candidates?
Yes, I did speak to some constituents out there, some voters, and, you know, they did notice that, you know, when they went to go vote, they noticed that there weren't many selections to choose from. They were a little bit concerned by that, a little bit also joking about it as well. But, you know, they quickly turned their attention back to the national elections. Mm-hmm. But they did make the note of that, that they noticed that there weren't too many people to vote from.
Weren't too many people to vote for. So people were a little confused. No. Talk a little bit about what happens next. You mentioned these cases that are heading to court now from the candidates who wanted to push this further. But there's also been talk about a special election. What might that look like?
Well, assuming the cases are heard as soon as possible, tentatively, from what I'm told, perhaps a special election for the chapter level positions would take place sometime in February 2025.
That's a ways mm-hmm. off, like February of next year. What does that mean, or what could it mean for these positions? That are they going to be empty until then?
Well, the current chapter officials who are in there will stay in there until January 10. So it'll be more or less about a month that those positions will be open. But that said, you know, a lot of things do occur in January. Perhaps like last year, for instance, the nomination in higher elevation areas experienced a lot of heavy snowfall, mm-hmm. which really a lot of the citizens became trapped in their homes. Emergency situations occurred, you know, and a lot of these actions begin at the chapter level. Because a lot of the chapter officials are very familiar with who their constituents are. And there is a little bit of anxiety there relating to that. Like, what if something like that happens again? You know, and then there's no one in there in these positions to really help emergency officials, you know, sort out who needs to become priority over someone else. So I think that's just one thing that they're looking at right now. I know that at the Division of Community Development, that is one of the things they're looking at. And they're under the executive branch, under President Bunaigaran and Vice President Rochelle Montoya.
So there could be some real implications to not having folks in those positions if that's what ends up happening. Remind us, Donovan, a little bit about why these new laws were put into place. Like, the motivation here was to create more accountability among candidates, but there was a big disconnect, it seems, when so many candidates didn't follow that law, that financial disclosure law.
Well, according to Navajo Nation Board of Election Supervisors Chairman Melvin Harrison, he said in the past, you know, that they've tried to enforce candidates to campaign expense report, turn those in. But because there was really no law in place, mm-hmm. They really couldn't enforce it. And now that they have this new law in place, according to Melvin Harrison, again, he says that, you know, when candidates filed for these positions, they were told at that time that they need to be aware of this new law that's in place, that they need to turn in their expense reports in a timely manner or else face something. And this result, they face disqualification.
Right, right. So there also has been some action from at least one Navajo Nation Council delegate, right, to deal with this. She introduced emergency legislation that could address the overwhelming number of disqualifications that happened. What would that legislation do?
Well, Brenda Jesus did introduce an emergency legislation to rescind the new law, but they, during a special session, the council spoke about that, and it was quickly shot down, actually. I guess they had a 5-day comment period, and a lot of folks expressed their opinions about Jesus's legislation, saying that, you know, the new law is in place for a reason, leave it alone, the candidates should know the law. So therefore, you know, they should be held accountable for it. And so Jesus decided to go with that reason, and the legislation dropped or died pretty quick.
Mm. So let me ask you lastly, some of the candidates who were kicked off the ballot and some of their supporters have argued that this wasn't handled correctly, that the time to file a grievance wasn't sufficient. They didn't have enough time to make that happen. How has the nation responded?
It's a mix. A lot of the supporters, like you said, do express that. They have expressed their disappointment. They do show the support with these I guess you could say, outgoing candidates now, outgoing folks who, a lot of them were running for re-election. So particularly with those people, their constituents really were supporting them. But for other areas, you know, for folks who've been in these positions for very long periods of time, you know, the constituents basically have said, this is a good thing because now that some of these people are disqualified, it opens the door for new opportunity. It opens the door for, you know, progress to continue. Whereas before, under these now outgoing elected officials, you know, nothing was really happening. So it's a mix.
Okay, we'll leave it there for now and find out what happens more in the future. Donovan Quintero, freelance reporter for the Navajo Times, joining us to talk more about this story. Donovan, thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, how a writer took on a different identity to explore the Southwest in her new detective novel. But first, 20 years ago, a platoon of Army Rangers came upon an abandoned Humvee in a dense slot canyon in Afghanistan. The platoon leader radioed his commander to ask what they should do and received orders to split the platoon and to try to guide the Humvee through the narrow twists and turns of the canyon. The platoon split up and began the trek, but before long, gunfire broke out. Members of the lead squad ran back to help the group riding with the Humvee. Machine guns rattled and echoed off the rocks. Smoke bombs flared. And before long, two soldiers were dead. Neither of them were members of the Taliban. One of the soldiers was an Afghan militiaman named Syed Farhad, and the other was Pat Tillman, a former safety for the Arizona Cardinals and linebacker for the ASU Sun Devils. Tillman enlisted in the Army Rangers shortly after the terrorist attacks of September 11th, leaving behind the millions he was earning in the NFL. As he put it at the time, so many other people had signed up to defend their country, whereas he hadn't, quote, done a damn thing. But when Tillman was deployed to Iraq, he quickly grew disillusioned with the U.S. war effort, reportedly telling friends that what America doing was, quote, illegal. In the wake of his death, the Army initially claimed that Tillman was wounded in combat and awarded him a Silver Star for valor. But the truth was more complicated. He'd actually been killed by friendly fire, something his platoon mates knew but were told not to talk about. Tillman's family was lied to, but when the truth finally came out, the military claimed there had not been a cover-up. To this day, the facts about what happened in that slot canyon and the aftermath of the skirmish are still being debated. Jeremy Schapp is a reporter and host at ESPN, and his latest documentary for the channel is Pat Tillman, Life, Death, Legacy. He joins me now to talk about the project. And Jeremy, I got the sense in this doc that your goal was to tell more than the story of just Pat Tillman.
It's the story of Pat Tillman. It's the story of the circumstances of his death and the aftermath and the misrepresentation of the circumstances of his death. But it's also about the lasting impact on so many people, on his mother, Danny, and on his platoon mates, several of whom we spoke to for this project. And after two decades, you know, the toll that all of this has taken emotionally on so many people.
Yeah. Well, I'm really glad you brought up the conversations with the other members of Tillman's platoon, because those are some of the most wrenching moments in the doc. There's a part where I think his name is Stephen Elliott.
Yeah.
He's one of Pat Tillman's former platoon mates. And he says, the idea that I would have been shooting my machine gun at a member of my own platoon in that moment would have made about as much sense as if you told me one of my family members was up on that ridge.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
And it just struck me as like such a clear and rare insight into the kind of thing that is going through a soldier's mind in a moment of chaos.
You know, you're just hoping that the people are comfortable enough to get to a place where they can share their emotional truth with you. You know, when Stephen Elliott talks about that moment and they've just been ambushed by the enemy, he's thinking to himself like, you know, I'm firing where my squad leader, the sergeant in the vehicle, is firing. And the thought that standing up there on that ridge are, you know, three guys on my side, it just never occurred to him. you know, the pain he feels that so many of these platoon mates feel that we spoke to, you know, that some people blamed us. But look at the difficulty of the situation. Look at the situation that they were put in. If you go on the internet, you know, to see other people say, you know, this was a conspiracy or you guys did it intentionally, it's just unspeakable.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in a similar vein, in the conversation that you have with Danny Tillman, Pat's mom, the part where she says something to the effect of, okay, so there has been this admission that there was wrongdoing, people looking the other way in the military during their investigation. And she says something to the effect of, like, what's that supposed to do for me? I thought that was interesting because in a lot of the other coverage of Tillman's death and his family that I have read or watched, there's a lot of focus on Danny Tillman as this kind of remarkable figure. You know, she was like a scholar of history, didn't have a TV.
And relentless.
And completely relentless, brave, you know, gave testimony, all of these things. But it felt like in this doc, she got to just be a parent.
Mm. Yeah. You know, so much of what she says is so heartbreaking. She's so emotionally raw. And I think she's so astute with her observations about herself. You know, to me, that fascinating part where she says, look, I know people are going to think I was nuts, but I believe these conspiracy theories. I believe that the Army tried to orchestrate his death, you know, to keep him quiet because he wasn't going to support their causes, et cetera, et cetera. And she says, I know how crazy that sounds now, but that process of getting there, to being able to recognize that, you know, for her, it's hard. She talked about, you know, letting go, not letting go of Pat. She'll never let go of her son, Pat Tillman, but letting go of this mission. You know, in some ways it's defined who she's been for 20 years.
Yeah. So speaking of the lies that were told to Danny Tillman, one of the biggest moments in the doc is obviously the conversation that you have with Pete Guerin, who was the Secretary of the Army at the time of the investigations. And as you point out, he hasn't talked about this in 15 years. Tell me about the process of approaching him and convincing him to speak on the record finally.
Yeah, that was a very interesting. So I reached out to Pete Guerin, Secretary Guerin, who's a former congressman as well, former Democratic congressman from the Fort Worth area. And initially, he agreed to do an interview. And then he decided he didn't want to do an interview, which people do. You know, it's certainly their prerogative. We don't have subpoena power or anything like that. And then we got on the phone, he and I think we spent about an hour on the phone together. And at that point, he had changed his mind again. And he told me that he felt a kind of obligation to talk about the death of Pat Tillman and the war in Afghanistan in general. And he was certainly displeased with the decisions made, as he said, by both the Trump administration and the Biden administration, the way that the American withdrawal from Afghanistan was handled. But he wanted to talk about, through Pat Tillman, the sacrifices and the commitment of the 7,000 plus American service members who were killed in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah. I mean, it was a really interesting moment in the doc for a variety of reasons. But one of them I felt at sort of a meta level is it was such a critical illustration of the value of telling a story like this 20 years later, even though it has already been told. Because culturally, the way that we look back on the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan now is so different than it was in, say, 2006, when there was a big Sports Illustrated profile of Pat Tillman, or 2009 or 10, when the John Krakauer book came out. That era of American foreign policy is seen with so much more clarity. And it lends just like a little bit of a different flavor, I guess, to the urgency or the mission, let's call it, of talking about the long-term effects of incidents like the Tillman story on people who were involved in those conflicts.
There's no doubt about that. You know, in particular, right, since the American withdrawal from Afghanistan, which I think took place right in the summer of 2021. So now it's been 3 years and we were there for 20 years. Pat Tillman was one of those who died in our efforts in Afghanistan after taking the country out from under the control of the Taliban. And now it's back under the control of the Taliban. And that's something, you know, that Pete Guerin is angry about. You know, this is history. It's recent history, right? But for millions and millions of people, it's hard to remember what it felt like in those moments on 9/11 and the way that some people responded. And when we think about, you know, Pat Tillman, you know, he was a potent symbol as well. He was the guy who left the NFL to join the fight. And as Danny Tillman said, Pat died doing what he volunteered to do, defending the country.
Yeah.
I really do feel the more you learn about Pat Tillman, you know how often, like, the more you learn about people who seem to be heroic, the less impressed you are. It really is the opposite with Pat Tillman, right? He was striving, right, to not letting other people fight for his freedom. It's about somebody who walked the walk, right?
Well, Jeremy Schapp is a reporter at ESPN and the host of the E60 documentary, Pat Tillman, Life, Death, Legacy. Jeremy, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman. Lizette Trujillo worries about her son and what might happen to him if an upcoming Supreme Court decision goes a certain way. It stems from the state of Tennessee and a law that bans gender-affirming care for transgender youth. The Supreme Court is set to hear the case next month. Trujillo is a Tucson small business owner, and her son is transgender. She wrote about it recently in an opinion piece in the Arizona Mirror, and my co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with her more about it.
There has been millions of dollars spent on misinforming people around what access to care looks like. Mm-hmm. And when it came to us and our experience and the experience of many families that I have been in community with since our journey began in 2015, is that these are really thoughtful conversations that are had between a pediatrician and a therapist and the families regarding what gender-affirming care will look like, what it could look like for their child. And it's not all the same, right? Like, people will have varying needs when it comes to the healthcare that they need. What is really, really important is that when women and or transgender people lose access to their bodily autonomy, we all lose. And we're seeing this when it comes to the reproductive rights fight that is happening. We've seen the loss of many women's lives. And so I firmly believe that it was really important to talk about this because those intersections meet. And my child deserves to live a healthy, happy life and have access to care that is personal and private. And that has been decided and talked about for years between us and our care team.
So, right, like, take us into that process a little bit. You write about this a little bit in the Mirror, and it's really interesting. Talk about the process of getting gender-affirming care for your son. Like, did you have concerns at the beginning about what this might look like, long-term effects, side effects, things like that?
I think all families, all parents have concerns mm-hmm. around what that will look like. And you ask those questions of your provider, and they are very open and clear about what gender-affirming care might look like for your family and your child.
Right.
I think that it's really, really important that there is a lot of scientific data that supports gender-affirming care. For us personally, a lot of times gender-affirming care for us in the beginning of Daniel's social transition and the early parts of his life just meant that he walked into a doctor's office where his name was correctly used and so were his pronouns and he was respected. And so oftentimes it could have been for an earache or a broken wrist, which he did like in sixth grade skateboarding. But what gender-affirming care often is just respecting the person that's sitting in front of you. Also, many pediatricians will talk about what are the impacts of blockers, which have been used for decades for various things for youth when they're in precocious puberty or for other various needs that kids will have. And so, again, this debate shouldn't be a public one. We should have the right to make private medical decisions that are appropriate for our child and his healthcare needs.
You talk in this piece about some of the things that parents of trans kids like you are accused of, right? Like that you're often accused of being, you know, like permissive parents who sort of say yes to whatever their kids want, or that maybe you're ideological, that you're indoctrinating your kids into believing they're somebody else or they're something else. Have you found any truth in any of that in your experience?
Not at all. So when my child went to his third year pediatric visit, the doctor asked all these developmental questions. And one of the developmental questions was, are you a boy or a girl? And I remember my child looked at us and smiled and said, boy, and then hopped, because hopping and walking backwards were part of these developmental requests, right? And the doctor looked at my child and said, no, you are a girl. And the doctor looked at me and I was in shock about what happens next. Mm. And then we just moved on, right? And from that moment, gender became very much not a conversation, but showed up so much in our journey, right? People will ask me, when did you know? And it wasn't one moment. It was a lot of moments over the course of many years where my child was asking to be seen, acknowledged, and accepted. Mm-hmm. And my husband and I didn't do those things until he was 8 and a friend acknowledged him as him. And when I asked my child, is this how you see yourself? Is this what's happening? My child said, yes, I know that in my heart and in my mind, I am a boy. I think when we're having this conversation around medical care, there's this idea that we don't have an understanding around a person's biological makeup. And that's not really at the core of what happens when we are supporting our children. Mm-hmm. We are acknowledging the fact that they are having a different and incongruent gender experience, and we're choosing to love and affirm and protect them in a world that says that they should not know who they are. My son will say he very clearly understands who he is and that he faces challenges because he is who he is and lives openly and freely in that way. Mm-hmm. And our family providing him the support and love and medical care that he deserves makes him navigating this very challenging moment easier.
There are other laws that have been passed to do with transgender youth in Arizona. You've spoken about some of them, and your son has as well in the past. And you wrote this line in your op-ed that I want to read. It says, as a mom, it's a horrible feeling to have so many people so loudly hate kids like my son. Talk a little bit about the kind of toll that the accumulation, the conversation, it sounds like, has on not just him, but your family.
It's been a hard, long few years. In 2018, we saw around 20 plus anti-trans bills in the state of Arizona. And then in 2024, there were more than 600 across the country. We saw 85 get passed. And obviously, Scrimeti versus Tennessee is one of those cases that's now going to be heard at the Supreme Court on December 4th. And our family will be at the ACLU rally out in front of SCOTUS that day. It's been hard, but the silver lining is that while this debate is hurtful and often can lead to violence against transgender people, more and more people have an understanding around who trans people are and that trans people exist in our communities. That part I am grateful for, but it has taken its toll. The silver lining for me was I was doing a panel with my son not too long ago, and he said, my parents have loved and affirmed me so much that I can walk through this world with confidence and love for myself and for who I am. And I think that regardless of the years of stress and advocacy that we've had to put in to show up at the state legislature every year to give a human face to this issue, it's been worth it. And I hope that other families of trans youth know that they aren't alone.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. Lizette Trujillo, she's a Tucson small business owner, parent advocate for transgender youth and families. Her recent op-ed appeared in the Arizona Mirror. Lizette, thank you so much for coming on the show. Thank you for telling us about this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
As the West continues to deal with ongoing drought, many water users are trying to figure out how to use less water. Water managers are also working to better gauge how much water is actually being used. New research and satellites may be able to help, especially as it relates to groundwater. Scientists from the Desert Research Institute used a platform called OpenET to monitor water use at agricultural fields in Nevada and Oregon. Thomas Ott is a research hydrologist at the Desert Research Institute. He spoke with my co-host Mark Brody about what they found, starting with what researchers were trying to figure out with this research.
Yeah, so the goal of the study was to really assess OpenET's ability to estimate field-scale water use. So like how much water is a farmer using in a field to grow a certain crop.
And this would be important, especially for those farms that are using groundwater, right?
Yes, especially so. And any kind of water as well. There are many farms that use surface water, groundwater, or a combination of the two. So understanding how much water is being used, especially if there's not really any meter or any recording of on the farmer side of what's being used, it's really important to be able to assess that.
So how exactly does OpenET work?
Yeah, so OpenET, ET stands for evapotranspiration, right? That is the water use that is a combination from two sources. So one source is evaporation. So think of a lake or wet soil that evaporates water into the atmosphere, you know, from the Earth's surface. Mm-hmm. The other component is transpiration. So that's water used through a plant. So soaked up through the roots and out through the leaves. So we combine this into evapotranspiration. The open part is the availability of the data. So the idea is to have this estimates of evapotranspiration open to the public and easily accessible by not only water managers, but also like individual farmers as well.
So how exactly then are you able to use this data to determine maybe how much water a particular farm or particular field is using?
Yeah, that's a good question. So it's not exactly a one-to-one. So the amount of evapotranspiration that comes off the surface, right, that we're estimating from the satellite is kind of a proxy for how much water was applied by irrigation. It's not always one-to-one, and that was kind of the intention of this study to see how that difference occurred. So this kind of comes into the play of efficiency, right? So how much water applied is actually used by the crop. In this case, the way OpenET does this is it runs six models, basically. It uses a couple different sources of data. The main source is land surface temperature from the satellite. So think of an irrigated or watered grass, right? If you're walking on the grass when it's wet, it feels a lot cooler than it does if you were walking either on dirt or asphalt.
Yeah.
That because of a lot of that energy is going to evaporating that water and it cools the surface. And we can see that from the satellites that these cooler surfaces are using more water.
Is the calculation then that if there is more evapotranspiration, that might mean that there was more groundwater, more other kinds of water used in that field to begin with?
Yes, exactly. It's pretty much directly correlated. So more evapotranspiration indicates more irrigated water.
Are you able to use this kind of data to measure groundwater in general, or does it have to be only groundwater that is pumped to the surface and used for something?
Yeah, so you can really only see the water that's being used by the plant, right, in terms of OpenET. So the water that goes back into the soil and percolates back down to the groundwater, right, we don't see that. Or water that's run off into a stream or something, we don't see that.
With the kinds of calculations you can do, though, are there implications for being able to measure groundwater use, or at least approximate the amount of groundwater used in a particular area?
Yeah, very much so. So it kind of depends on what's going on at the surface, right? Because we can't really distinguish if it's surface water or groundwater looking at OpenET. We can only say something about how much water was evaporated right off the surface, or I should say evapotranspired. So there's additional information that's needed in order to understand if that water was sourced from groundwater or if it was sourced from surface water. In the case of Diamond Valley in Nevada, which is where the study was done, we had pretty high confidence. Well, actually, we knew most of those fields were groundwater only. There were only a few surface water fields that we knew of, and we knew where those were. So we were able to account for that.
Well, it sounds like if you are looking at specific farms or specific fields and you know what their source of water is, that kind of takes that variable out of the equation.
Exactly. Yeah. So if you know, a field is 100% groundwater, or if there was low surface water that year and they had a supplement through higher amounts of groundwater, then that can be informed for partitioning out that estimate from, you know, OpenET, how much came from each source.
How close was the data that you found relative to what earlier estimates might have suggested, you know, in terms of how much water could have been used?
So in terms of comparing the meter data, which is, you know, the data that the farmers reported to the state for how much water was being used, which is basically the best data you can. There's a meter on the pump that they're pumping, and they know directly how much water is being used. When we compared those numbers to OpenET estimates, they were within 13%, which is really good, honestly. We were pretty excited to see how well OpenET was estimating the water use in these cases. Compared to historical estimates, there hasn't really been any way to really estimate or measure ET per individual field. Historical methods typically they look at crop type, so they know how much water alfalfa typically uses. So then they'll, you know this field is alfalfa, so they'll take that and use that number directly, which is typically an upper bound because those numbers assume that the crop is healthy, it's well irrigated. There's a lot of other complicating factors that can change that number. So if a crop is older, or if it's diseased, or if there is poor soil conditions, that optimal number typically comes down. So OpenET can see that in the satellite, right? Because if it's using less water, that surface temperature is going to be hotter. So then that difference shows up in the data.
So how ideally would you like this data to be used going forward? Or how do you think this data should be used going forward?
So the main goal is to make well-informed decisions. So from our perspective, we want to provide the best data we can in order to make the decisions well-informed. So in order to, I think there's an old adage, you can't manage what you don't measure. So the idea here is we want to be able to measure and estimate water use in basins so that they can make good management decisions on how much water is available and how much water can be used, with the main goal of providing water security. There's so much economic and livelihoods that are provided with water, and we want to ensure that water is available for decades to come. We don't want, you know, basins to be pumped dry, and it's important to know how much water is being used.
Sure. All right. That is Thomas Ott, a research hydrologist with the Desert Research Institute. Thomas, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Good morning. You're listening to The Show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman. Kate Christensen is a novelist. If you go to her website, you'll see 11 books attributed to her. But upon closer examination, Christensen appears to have only written 10 of them. The most recent novel is called The Arizona Triangle, and it's a detective novel attributed to someone named Sidney Graves. Now, I recently read The Arizona Triangle, which tells the story of the mysterious death of a poet, and I'm actually joined now by the author of the book. I guess the first question of this interview is, what should I call you?
That's a really hard question to answer because it's an open secret that I'm Kate Christensen. So I guess call me Kate.
Okay.
And then the author of the book is Sidney Graves. And I'd be happy to talk about this whole distinction also.
Well, you have anticipated my first question. tell me about that.
It's so funny. I've always wanted to write detective fiction.
Uh-huh.
And it never occurred to me that I would do it under a pseudonym. But as I was writing this book, I felt a different literary persona emerge. I had been spending a lot of time, my mother lives just north of Tucson, and so I'd been spending a lot of time there and thinking, walking in the foothills of Mount Lemmon, thinking about murder. And I was thinking, like, this is outlaw country. This is a place to set a murder. The book sort of announced itself to me.
Okay, so if I'm hearing you right, the story came to you before the persona.
Yes.
Okay.
The setting came to me first. And there's something about Southwestern noir I'm thinking about Sue Grafton and, of course, Raymond Chandler and Donald Westlake and Sarah Grahn. And they're all writers of the dark desert. And the idea that the detective is, I think, more than other detective traditions, connected to identifying with the criminal.
Yeah. Well, that's particularly interesting to me in light of your detective character, Jo Baelin, because she spent some time as a cop and she has seen the corruption and graft that can often be part of that work. And she ends up leaving the force because she doesn't want to be part of it. But there is a very real sense that while she doesn't want to be part of it, it's not like she doesn't understand it or have empathy for the people who are drawn towards it, right? Is that fair to say?
That's so fair to say. Yeah, that's exactly right. I was thinking about the cerebral sort of puzzle solvers of British crime novels.
Uh-huh.
And the Scandinavian sort of hapless cops who are very much embedded in their kind of socialist countries and their more codified societies. And I wanted to graft that onto a hard-boiled Southwestern voice.
So one of the reasons that this phenomenon of you assuming a different identity to write this book is fascinating to me is that one of the big questions at the center of the book is whether a poet has fabricated significant parts of her identity.
Yes.
What was interesting to you about that storyline, and was it at all related to, like, did that idea occur to you after you had decided to become Sidney Graves?
No, actually, I think deciding to become Sidney Graves kind of came out of what the book is really about, which is, yes, you're so right. It has to do with a poet who fakes Navajo identity, which is something that was in the news a lot at the time. It made me think about the slipperiness of who we are, how we present ourselves to the world, and how we can make ourselves into something else. And that's a very uniquely American thing too, especially Western. And the idea of what is the American identity, really?
Yeah. Well, there's an interesting cultural tension, I guess, in some of the secondary and tertiary characters in the story, where there are Native American folks who play a critical role in the story. And then there are also this group of hippie artists who have set up this compound in the middle of the desert and just kind of claimed this unlikely space as a place for, like, wanton self-expression. And one of the things I found interesting is it seemed like Sidney Graves, I'll say, if not Kate, had an equal amount of affection and understanding for both of those constituencies.
I'm really interested in the very different groups of people who sort of coexist, and the idea of Arizona and Bohemia and this old dude ranch that is now populated by a lot of baby boomer artists who moved there in the 70s. And this gets actually into British crime territory, the idea of a closed system, like a very small British village, and the idea of people recombining as couples, reusing all the material, staying connected in spite of everything, all the old loyalties, all the old rifts. Mm-hmm. And there's something about that that I think lends itself well to murder.
There is, but it also strikes me again that there's an interesting way that you're departing from tradition there, because the other thing I associate with particularly those British mystery stories is that the reaction of everybody except the lead detective is, we just can't believe that something like this would happen here.
Yes. No, you're completely right. There's in British crime fiction, a murder is seen as, you know, a big sort of rip in the fabric of a very closely woven society. And in Scandinavian noir, it's that weary kind of acceptance that human darkness is always with us. And murder, the most grisly murders are to be expected. But I think in Southwestern noir, it's more of a style. It's like murder is kind of cool. It's neon streaked. It's like back alleys and old files and, you know, the detective kind of flirting with the gray areas of the law and identifying with the killer to find him or her. It's more porous.
Well, so that idea makes me think about the voice of Jo as a character, because she has this very kind of dishy energy, like she's always kind of letting us in on a secret. And it often feels like we're reading her diary. How did that voice come to you? Do you remember any particular moment when you felt like this is her? This is how she writes about herself.
Yes. I love that you call her Dishy. I love that because the idea was to let you in fully to her brain.
Yeah.
And one of the great pleasures of a detective novel is the psychological connection to a detective that mm-hmm. we get. The pleasure of the kind of person who's a detective, which is the kind of person who's a novelist. And, you know, nosy and observant. And the process of writing a novel is so much like the process of solving a crime that I felt this pleasurable fusion of Sidney Graves with Joe Balin, neither of whom is precisely me.
I love that you said it's the same kind of person who writes a novel, because one of the things that Joe Balin tells us that is at the heart of her investigative approach is that sometimes she just needs to go places and talk to people and ask questions to satisfy her own curiosity without even necessarily knowing why she's asking that question or if it's connected to the case. She just kind of needs to intuitively feel her way through it until an answer presents itself, which strikes me as, I mean, that's something you hear authors say a lot. And I wonder if that's true for you too, that sometimes it's like, this just feels like what I need to write about right now. I'll figure out if it's part of the story later.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Mm-hmm. And so she's the kind of detective that I am, a novelist,
uh-huh.
as opposed to Hercule Poirot, who I think of as a brain in a jar.
Yes.
With a mustache.
Well, Kate Christensen writes as Sidney Graves, and Sidney is the author of the new book, The Arizona Triangle, a Joe Balin detective novel, the first in a series. Kate/Sidney, thank you so much.
That was so much fun. Thank you.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.